Chapter 5. Spending spree. Inadvisability of golem back rubs. Giving away money. Some observations on the nature of trust. Mr. Bent has a visitor, one of the family. Where do you test a bankable idea? Not in a bank, that was certain. You needed to test it where people paid far more attention to money and juggled their finances in a world of constant risk, where a split-second decision meant the difference between triumphant profit or ignominious loss. Generically, it was known as the real world, but one of its proprietary names was 10th Egg Street. The Boffo Novelty and Joke Shop in 10th Egg Street, J. Proust Prop, was a haven for everyone who thought that fart powder was the last word in humour, which, in many respects, it is. It had caught Moist's eye, though, as a source of material for disguises and other useful things. Moist had always been careful about disguises. A moustache that could come off at a tug had no place in his life. But since he had the world's most forgettable face, a face that was still a face in the crowd even when it was by itself, it helped, sometimes, to give people something to tell the watch about. Spectacles were an obvious choice, but Moist achieved very good results with his own design of nose and ear wigs. Show a man a pair of ears that small songbirds had apparently nested in, watch the polite horror in his eyes, and you could be certain that would be all he would remember. Now, of course, he was an honest man, but part of him felt it necessary that he should keep his hand in, just in case. Today, he bought a pot of glue and a large jar of fine gold sprinkles, because he could see a use for them.
"That'll be 35p, Mr. Litwig," said Mr. Proust. "Any new stamps coming along?"
"One or two, Jack," said Moist. "How's Ethel?" "And little Roger," he added, after only a moment's shuffle through the files in his head.
"Very well, thank you for asking. Can I get you anything else?" Proust added hopefully, in case Moist might have a sudden recollection that life would be considerably improved by the purchase of a dozen false noses.
Moist glanced at the array of masks, scary rubber hands, and joke noses, and considered his needs satisfied.
"Only my change, Jack," he said, and carefully laid one of his new creations on the counter. "Just give me half a dollar."
Proust stared at it as if it might explode or vent some mind-altering gas.
"What's this, sir?"
"A note for a dollar."
"A dollar bill?
It's the latest thing."
"Do I have to sign it or anything?"
"No, that's the interesting bit. It's a dollar. It can be anyone's."
"I'd like it to be mine, thank you."
"It is now," said Moist, "but you can use it to buy things."
"There's no gold in it," said the shopkeeper, picking it up and holding it away from his body just in case.
"Well, if I paid in pennies and shillings, there would be no gold in them either, right? As it is, you're 15p ahead, and that's a good place to be, agreed? And that note is worth a dollar. If you take it along to my bank, they'll give you a dollar for it."
"But I've already got a dollar."
"Haven't I?" Proust added.
"Good man! So why not go out in the street and spend it right now? Come on, I want to see how it works."
"Is this like the stamps, Mr. Litwig?" said Proust, scrambling for something he could understand. "People sometimes pay me in stamps, me doing a lot of mail order."
"Yes, yes, exactly. Think of it as a big stamp. Look, I'll tell you what, this is an introductory offer. Spend that dollar, and I'll give you another bill for a dollar, so that you'll still have a dollar."
"So what are you risking?"
"Only, if this is, like, you know, one of the first dollar bills, right? Well, my lad bought some of the first stamps you did, right? And now they're worth a mint, so if I hang on to it, it'll be worth money some day."
"It's worth money now," Moist wailed.
That was the trouble with slow people. Give him a fool any day, slow people took some time to catch up, but when they did, they rolled right over you.
"Yeah, but, see," and here the shopkeeper grinned what he probably thought was an artful grin, which, in fact, made him look like Mr. Fusspot halfway through a toffee. "You're a sly one with them stamps, Mr. Litwig, bringing out different ones all the time. My granny says, if it's true a man's got enough iron in his blood to make a nail, then you've got enough brass in your neck to make a doorknob, no offence meant. She speaks her mind as my granny. I've made the mail run on time, haven't I?"
"Oh, yes. Gran says you may be a slippery Jim, but you get things done, no doubt about it.
Right, let's spend the damn dollar then, shall we?"
"Is it some kind of duplex magical power I have," he wondered, "that lets old ladies see right through me but like what they see?"
And thus Mr. Proust decided to hazard his dollar in the shop next door,
on an ounce of Jolly Sailor pipe tobacco, some mints, and a copy of What Novelty. And Mr. Natty Polforth, once the exercise was explained to him, accepted the note and took it across the road to Mr. Drayman, the butcher, who cautiously accepted it, after having things set out fair and square for him, in payment for some sausages, and also gave Moist a bone for your little doggy. It was more than likely that Mr. Fusspot had never seen a real bone before. He circled it carefully, waiting for it to squeak. 10th Egg Street was a street of small traders who sold small things in small quantities for small sums on small profits. In a street like that, you had to be small-minded. It wasn't the place for big ideas. You had to look at the detail. These were men who saw far more farthings than dollars. Some of the other shopkeepers were already closing up for the day. Drawn by the Ankh-Morpokian's instinct for something interesting, the traders drifted over to see what was going on. They all knew one another. They all dealt with one another, and everyone knew Moist von Lipwig, the man in the gold suit. The notes were examined with much care and solemn discussion. "It's just an IOU or marker, really." "All right, but supposing you needed the money. But correct me if I'm wrong, isn't the IOU the money?" "All right, then. Who owes it to you?" "Jack here, because..." No, hang on. It is the money, right?" Moist grinned as the discussion wobbled back and forth. Whole new theories of money were growing here like mushrooms, in the dark and based on bullshit. But these were men who counted every half-farthing and slept at night with the cash-box under their bed. They'd weigh out flour and raisins and rainbow sprinkles with their eyes ferociously focused on the scale's pointer, because they were men who lived in the margins. If he could get the idea of paper money past them, then he was home and, if not dry, then at least merely moist. "So you think these might catch on?" he said during a lull. The consensus was, yes, they could, but should look fancier, in the words of Natty Polforth. You know, with more fancy lettering and similar. Moist agreed, and handed a note to every man as a souvenir. It was worth it. "And if it all goes wahoony-shaped," said Mr. Proust, "you've still got the gold, right? Locked up down there in the cellar." "Oh, yes, you've got to have the gold," said Mr. Drayman. There was a general murmur of agreement, and Moist felt his spirits slump. "But I thought we'd all agreed that you don't need the gold," he said. In fact, they hadn't, but it was worth a try. "Ah, yes, but it's got to be there somewhere," said Mr. Drayman.
"It keeps the banks honest,"
said Mr. Polforth, in the tone of plonking certainty that is the hallmark of that most knowledgeable of beings, the man in the pub. "But I thought you understood," said Moist. "You don't need the gold."
"Right, sir, right," said Mr. Polforth soothingly. "Just so long as it's there."
"Do you happen to know why it has to be there?" said Moist.
"Keeps banks honest,"
said Mr. Polforth, on the basis that truth is achieved by repetition. And with nods all round, this was the feeling of 10th Egg Street. So long as the gold was somewhere, it kept banks honest and everything was okay. Moist felt humbled by such faith. If the gold was somewhere, herons would no longer eat frogs either. But in fact, there was no power in the world that could keep a bank honest if it didn't want to be. Still, not a bad start to his first day even so. He could build on it. It began to rain. Not hard, but the kind of fine rain where you can almost get away without an umbrella. No cabs bothered to trawl 10th Egg Street for trade, but there was one at the curb in Losing Street, the horse sagging in the harness, the driver hunched into his greatcoat, the lamps flickering in the dusk. With the rain getting to the blobby soaking stage, it was a sight for damp feet. He hurried over, climbed in, and a voice in the gloom said,
"Good evening, Mr. Lipwig. It's so nice to meet you at last. I'm Poochie. I'm sure we will be friends."
"No, you see, that was good," said Sergeant Colon of the Watch,
as the figure of Moist von Lipwig disappeared around the corner, still accelerating.
"He went right through the cab window without touching the sides and bounced off that bloke creeping up. Very nice roll as he landed, I thought, and he still had hold of the little dog all the whole time. Done it before, I shouldn't wonder. Nevertheless, I'm forced, on balance, to consider him a twit."
"The first cab," said Corporal Nobbs, shaking his head. "Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. I would not have thought of a man like him."
"My point exactly," said Colon. "When you know you've got enemies at large, never, ever get in the first cab. Fact of life. Even things what live under rocks know it."
They watched the former creeper gloomily picking up the remains of his iconograph, while Poochie screamed at him from the coach.
"I bet when the first cab was built, no one dared to get into it, eh, Sarge?"
said Nobby happily.
"I bet the first cabbie used to go home every night starving on account of everyone knowing, right?"
"Who knew, Nobby? People with no enemies at large would be okay, Nobby. Now, let's go and report."
"What does it mean, at large, anyway?" said Nobby as they ambled toward the Chitling Street watch-house and the certain prospect of a cup of hot, sweet tea.
"It means large enemies, Nobby. It's as clear as the nose on your face, especially yours."
"Well, she's a large girl, that Poochie Lavish."
"And nasty enemies to have, that family," Colon opined. "What's the odds?"
"Odds, Sarge?" said Nobby innocently.
"You're running a book, Nobby. You always run a book."
"Can't get any takers, Sarge. Foregone conclusion," said Nobby.
"All right. Sensible. Lipwig going to be found laying in chalk by Sunday."
"No, Sarge. Everyone thinks he'll win."
Moist woke up in the big, soft bed and strangled a scream.
"Poochie? Ah!" And in a state of what the delicately inclined called deshabille. He'd always wondered what deshabille looked like, but he'd never expected to see so much of it in one go. Even now, some of his memory cells were still trying to die. But he wouldn't be Moist von Lipwig if a certain amount of insouciance didn't rise to heal the wounds. He'd got away, after all. Oh, yes. It wasn't as though it was the first window he'd jumped through, and the sound of Pooch's scream of rage was almost as loud as the crack the man's iconograph made as it hit the cobbles. The old honey-trap game. But it really was time he did something illegal, just to get his mind back to crooked. He wouldn't have got into the first cab a year ago, that was for sure. Mind you, it'd be a strange jury that believed he could be attracted to Poochie Lavish. He couldn't see that standing up in court. He got up, dressed, and listened hopefully for signs of life from the kitchen. In their absence, he made himself some black coffee. Armed with this, he made his way into the office, where Mr. Fusspot dozed in his in-tray, and the official top hat sat accusingly black. Ah, yes, he was going to do something about that, wasn't he? He reached into his pocket and pulled out the little pot of glue, which was one of the convenient ones with a brush and a lid, and after some careful spreading began to pour the glittering flakes as smoothly as he could. He was still engrossed in this exercise when Gladys loomed in his vision like an eclipse of the sun, holding what turned out to be a bacon and egg sandwich, 2 feet long and 1/8 of an inch thick. She'd also picked up his copy of the Times. He groaned. He'd made the front page. He usually did. It was his athletic mouth. It ran away with him whenever he saw a notebook. He'd made page 2 as well. Oh, and the lead editorial. Bugger. Even the political cartoon, too, the one that was never much of a laugh. First urchin. Why ain't Ankh-Morpork like a desert island? Second urchin. 'Cause when you're on a desert island, the sharks can't bite ya. It was side-splitting. His bleary eyes strayed back to the editorial. They, on the other hand, could be quite funny, since they were based on the assumption that the world would be a much better place if it was run by journalists. They were... What? What was this? Time to consider the unthinkable. Wind of change blowing through the vaults at last. Undoubted success of the new post office. Stamps already a de facto currency. Fresh ideas needed. Youth at the helm. Youth at the helm? This from William de Word, who was almost certainly the same age as Moist, but wrote editorials that suggested his bum was stuffed with tweed. It was sometimes hard to tell, in all the ponderousness, what de Word actually thought about anything, but it appeared, through the rolling fog of polysyllables, that the Times believed Moist von Lipwig to be, on the whole and all things considered, taking the long view and one thing with another, probably the right man in the right job. He was aware of Gladys behind him when red light glinted off the brasswork on the desk.
"You are very tense, Mr. Lipwig," she said.
"Yeah, right," said Moist, reading the editorial again. Ye gods, the man really did write as though he was chipping the letters in stone.
"There was an interesting article about back rubs in the lady's own magazine," Gladys went on.
Later on, Moist felt that perhaps he should have heeded the hopeful tone in her voice, but he was thinking, not just carved, but with big serifs, too.
"They are very good at relieving tension caused by the hurly-burly of modern life," Gladys intoned.
"Well, we certainly don't want any of that," said Moist. And everything went black. The strange thing was, he thought, when Peggy and Amesbury had brought him round and clicked his bones back into the appropriate sockets, that he actually felt a lot better. Perhaps that was the idea. Perhaps the hideous white-hot pain was there to make you realise that there were worse things in the world than the occasional twinge.
"I am very sorry," said Gladys. "I did not know that was going to happen. It said in the magazine that the recipient would experience a delightful frisson."
"I don't think that means you should be able to see your own eyeball," said Moist, rubbing his neck. Gladys's eyes dimmed so much that he was moved to add, "I feel much better now, though. It's so nice to look down and not see my heels."
"Don't you listen to him. It wasn't that bad," said Peggy with sisterly fellow-feeling. "Men always make a big fuss over a little pain."
"They are just big, cuddly babies, really," said Gladys.
That caused a thoughtful pause.
"Where did that come from?" said Moist.
"The information was imparted to me by Glenda at the stamp counter.
Well, from now on, I don't want you to—" The big doors swung open. They let in a hubbub from the floors below, and riding the noise like some kind of oral surfer was Mr. Bent, saturnine and far too shiny for this time of the morning.
"Good morning, master," he said icily. "The street outside is full of people, and might I take this opportunity to congratulate you on disproving a theory currently much in vogue at Unseen University?"
"Huh?" said Moist.
"There are some risible people like to suggest an infinite number of universes, in order to allow everything that may happen a place to happen in. This is, of course, nonsense, which they entertain only because they believe words are the same as reality. Now, however, I can disprove the theory, since in such an infinity of worlds there would have to be one where I would applaud your recent actions, and, let me assure you, sir, infinity is not that big."
Mr. Bent drew himself up.
"People are hammering on the doors. They want to close their accounts. I told you banking was about trust and confidence."
"Oh, dear," said Moist.
"They are asking for gold."
"I thought that's what you prom—"
"It is only a metaphorical promise.
I told you it is based on the understanding that no one will actually demand it."
"How many people want to withdraw their money?" said Moist.
"Nearly 20.
"Then they are making a lot of noise, aren't they?"
Mr. Bent looked uncomfortable.
"Well, there are some others," he said. "A few misguided people are seeking to open accounts, but—"
"How many?"
"About 200 or 300, but—"
"Opening accounts, you say?" said Moist.
Mr. Bent was squirming.
"Only for trifling sums, a few dollars here and there," he said dismissively. "It would appear that they think you have something up your sleeve."
The inverted commas shuddered, like a well-bred girl picking up a dead vole. Some of Moist recoiled, but part of him began to feel the wind on his face.
"Well, let's not disappoint them, shall we?" he said, picking up the gold top hat, which was still a bit sticky.
Bent glared at it.
"The other banks are furious, you know," he said, high-stepping hurriedly after Moist as the master of the Royal Mint headed for the stairs.
"Is that good or bad?" said Moist over his shoulder.
"Listen, what's the rule about bank lending? I heard it once. It's about interest."
"Do you mean borrow at 1/2, lend at 2, go home at 3? Said Bent.
"Right. I've been thinking about that. We could shave those numbers, couldn't we?"
"This is Ankh-Morpork. A bank has to be a fortress. That is expensive."
"But we could alter them a bit, couldn't we? And we don't pay interest on balances of less than $100, correct?"
"Yes, that is so."
"Well, from now on, anyone can open an account with $5, and we'll start paying interest a lot earlier. That'll smooth out the lumps in the mattresses, won't it?"
"Master, I protest, banking is not a game."
"Dear Mr. Bent, it is a game, and it's an old game called What Can We Get Away With?"
A cheer went up. They had reached an open landing that overlooked the hall of the bank like a pulpit overlooks the sinners, and a field of faces stared up at Moist in silence for a moment. Then someone called out,
"Are you going to make us all rich, Mr. Litwig?"
"Oh, damn," thought Moist, "why are they all here?"
"Well, I'm going to do my best to get my hands on your money," he promised.
This got a cheer. Moist wasn't surprised. Tell someone you were going to rob them, and all that happened was you got a reputation as a truthful man. The waiting ears sucked at his tongue, and his common sense went and hid. it heard his mouth add, and so I can get more of it, I think, that is to say the chairman thinks, that we should be looking at 1% interest on all accounts that have $5 in them for a whole year. There was a choking sound from the chief cashier, but no great stir from the crowd, most of whom were of the sock-under-the-mattress persuasion. In fact, the news did not appear to please. Then someone raised his hand and said, "That's a lot to pay just to have you stick our money in your cellar, isn't it?" "No, it's what I'll pay you to let me stick your money in my cellar for a year," said Moist.
"You will?"
"Certainly. Trust me."
The inquirer's face twisted into the familiar mask of a slow thinker trying to speed up.
"So, where's the catch?" he managed.
"Everywhere," thought Moist. "For one thing, I won't be storing it in my cellar. I'll be storing it in someone else's pocket, but you don't really need to know that right now."
"No catch," he said. "If you put $100 on deposit, then after a year it'll be worth $101.
"That's all very well for you to say, but where would the likes of me get $100?
"Right here. If you invest just $1 and wait for...
how long, Mr. Bent?" The chief cashier snorted.
461 years.
"OK, it's a bit of a wait, but your great-great-great-etc.-grandchildren will be proud of you," said Moist above all the laughter.
"But I'll tell you what I'll do. If you open an account here today for, $5, we'll give you a free dollar on Monday. A free dollar to take away, ladies and gentlemen, and where are you going to get a better deal than
a real dollar, pray, or one of these fakes?"
There was a commotion near the door, and Poochie Lavish swept in. Or at least tried to sweep. But a good sweep needs planning, and probably a rehearsal. You shouldn't just go for it and hope. All you get is a lot of shoving. The two heavies, there to clear a path through the press of people, got defeated by sheer numbers, which meant that the rather slimmer young men leading her exquisitely bred blonde hounds got stuck behind them. Poochie had to shoulder her way through. It could have been so good, Moist felt. It had all the right ingredients, the black-clad bruisers so menacing, the dogs so sleek and blonde. But Poochie herself had been blessed with beady, suspicious little eyes and a generous upper lip, which combined with the long neck to put the honest observer in mind of a duck who'd just been offended by a passing trout. Someone should have told her that black was not her colour, and that the expensive fur could have looked better on its original owners, that if you were going to wear high heels, then this week's fashion tip was don't wear sunglasses at the same time, because when you walked out of the bright sunlight into the relative gloom of, say, a bank, you would lose all sense of direction and impale the foot of one of your own bodyguards. Someone should have told her, in fact, that true style comes from innate cunning and mendacity. You can't buy it.
"Miss Poochie Lavish, ladies and gentlemen," said Moist, starting to clap as Poochie whipped her sunglasses off and advanced on the counter with murder in her eye. "One of the directors who will join us all in making money."
There was some clapping from the crowd, most of whom had never seen Poochie before but wanted the free show.
"I say, listen to me! Everyone listen to me!" she commanded.
She waved what seemed to Moist to look very much like his experimental dollar bills.
"This is just worthless paper. This is what he'll be giving you."
"No, it's the same as an open cheque or a banker's draft," said Moist.
"Really? We shall see. I say, good people of Ankh-Morpork, do any of you think this piece of paper could be worth a dollar? Would anyone give me a dollar for it?"
"Dunno, what is it?" said someone, and there was a buzz from the crowd.
"An experimental banknote," said Moist over the hubbub, "just to try out the idea."
"How many of them are there, then?" said the inquiring man.
"About 12," said Moist.
The man turned to Poochie.
"I'll give you $5 for it. How about that?"
"Five? It says it's worth one," said Poochie, aghast.
"Yeah, right. $5, miss."
"Why, are you insane?"
"I'm as sane as the next man, thank you, young lady."
$7 here," said the next man, raising a hand.
"This is madness," wailed Poochie.
"Mad?" said the next man. He pointed a finger at Moist. "If I'd bought a pocketful of the black penny stamps when that fella brought them out last year, I'd be a rich man."
"Anyone remember the triangle of blue?" said another bidder.
50 pence it cost.
I put one on a letter to my aunt. By the time it got there, it was worth $50. And the old baggage wouldn't give it back."
"It's worth 160 now," said someone behind him. "Auctioned at Dave's Stamp and Pin Emporium last week. $10 is my bid, miss."
"15 here."
Moist had a good view from the stairs. a small consortium had formed at the back of the hall, working on the basis that it was better to have small shares than none at all. Stamp collecting. It had started on day one, and then ballooned like some huge thing, running on strange, mad rules. Was there any other field where flaws made things worth more? Would you buy a suit just because one arm was shorter than the other, or because a bit of spare cloth was still attached? Of course, when Moist had spotted this, he'd put in flaws on purpose, as a matter of public entertainment, but he certainly hadn't planned for Lord Veterinary's head to appear upside down just once on every sheet of blues. One of the printers had been about to destroy them when Moist brought him down with a flying tackle. The whole business was unreal, and unreal was Moist's world. Back when he'd been a naughty boy, he'd sold dreams, and the big seller in that world was the one where you got very rich by a stroke of luck. He'd sold glass as diamonds because greed clouded men's eyes. Sensible, upright people who worked hard every day nevertheless believed against all experience in money for nothing. But the stamp collectors, they believed in small perfections. It was possible to get one small part of the world right. And even if you couldn't get it right, you at least knew what was missing. It might be, for instance, the flawed 50p triangular blue, but there were still six of them out there, and who knew what piece of luck might attend a dedicated searcher? Rather a lot of luck would be needed, Moist had to admit, because four of them were safely tucked away for a rainy day in a little lead box under the floorboards in Moist's office. Even so, two were out there somewhere, perhaps destroyed, lost, eaten by snails, or, and here hope lay thick as winter snow, were in some unregarded bundle of letters at the back of a drawer somewhere. And Miss Poochie simply didn't know how to work a crowd. She stomped and demanded attention, and bullied and insulted, and it didn't help that she'd called them good people, because no one likes an outright liar. And now she was losing her temper, because the bidding had reached $34, and now she'd torn it up. "That's what I think of this silly money," she announced, throwing the pieces in the air. Then she stood there, panting and looking triumphant, as if she'd done something clever. A kick in the teeth to everyone there. It made you want to cry. It really did. Oh, well. He pulled one of the new notes out of his pocket and held it up. "Ladies and gentlemen," he announced, "I have here one of the increasingly rare first-generation $1 notes." He had to pause for the laughter. "Signed by myself and the chairman. Bids over $40, please. All proceeds to the little kiddies." He ran it up to 50, bouncing a couple of bids off the wall. Poochie stood ignored and steaming with rage for a while, and then flounced out. It was a good flounce, too. She had no idea how to handle people, and she tried to make self-esteem do the work of self-respect. But the girl could flounce better than a fat turkey on a trampoline. The lucky winner was already surrounded by his unlucky fellow-bidders by the time he reached the bank's doors. The rest of the crowd surged toward the counters, not sure what was going on, but determined to have a piece of it. Moist cupped his hand and shouted, "And this afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bent and myself will be available to discuss bank loans." This caused a further stir. "Smoke and mirrors, Mr. Lipwig," said Bent, turning away from the balustrade. "Nothing but smoke and mirrors." "But done without smoke, and in a total absence of a mirror, Mr. Bent," said Moist cheerfully. "And the kiddies?" said Bent. "Find some. There's bound to be an orphanage that needs $50. It'll have to be an anonymous donation, of course." Bent looked surprised. "Really, Mr. Lipwig? I'll make no bones about saying that you seem to me to be the sort of man who makes a great raz-arm-martaz about giving money to charity." He made razzmatazz sound like some esoteric perversion. "Well, I'm not. Do good by stealth. That is my watchword. It'll get found out soon enough," he added to himself. "And then I'm not only a jolly good chap, but a decently modest one, too. I wonder, am I really a bastard, or am I just really good at thinking like one?" Nothing nudged at his mind. Tiny hairs on the back of his neck were twitching. Something was wrong, out of place, dangerous.